You're listening to the Just Powers podcast. I'm Dr. Sheena Wilson, principal investigator of the Just Powers National Team, co-founder of the Petrocultures Research Group, and a professor of media, communications, and energy humanities at Campus Saint-Jean, the Francophone faculty of the University of Alberta. On the Just Powers podcast, I invite you to think together with myself and my guests about climate justice issues and socially just approaches to energy transition, which for us means intersectional and decolonial approaches to shifting the ways we live and work. This podcast is based out of Amiskwichiwiskaigan on the Métis homelands and Treaty 6 territory where the city of Edmonton is located. We're now releasing the sixth podcast series entitled Reflector. In this series, we interview many of the 21 members of the Speculative Energy Futures team, which is one of the pillar projects of Just Powers. We talk to them about how they have been organizing around research creation methods to produce inter- and transdisciplinary research on energy transition and climate justice, to provoke all of us to imagine energy futures beyond what we currently understand to be possible. Patrick Mann is the guest host of the entire Reflector season's 8 episodes. Patrick is an artist, curator, and professor emeritus of visual arts at Western University in London, Ontario, located on the territories of the Anishinaabeg, the Haudenosaunee, the Lenapeweke, and the Chontaun nations on lands connected with the London townships and the Sombre Treaties of 1796 and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant Wampum. Patrick has deep commitments to decolonization and to climate remediation that motivate his busy life and practice, and he has been an important member of the Speculative Energy Futures team since 2017. In this first episode, we will discuss the inception of Speculative Energy Futures, as well as the project's methods and our big learnings. So I'm going to pass it over to you, Patrick, to take the series from here on out. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Sheena. It's wonderful to be joining you and our listeners for this podcast journey.
Great to have you, Patrick. Do you want to start by explaining to our listeners what they can anticipate with this season of Just Powers?
Absolutely. As you well know, Sheena, this truly is an epic project. From meeting each other for the first time in Edmonton and a second time in Banff, Alberta, to our many other sessions in person and on Zoom, to working as interdisciplinary teams to evolve a vast spectrum of approaches to articulating what energy transition is, how it works, and how we can creatively and imaginatively make it part of our lives, we have been busy. In short, in this podcast, we're going to be spending some time with thinkers, makers, and energy transition advocates, reflecting on the various stages of this mighty project. In essence, the podcast focuses on an urgent and innovative research undertaking and its results. Yet, as listeners will experience, our research creation methods often lead to the melding of research inquiry and creative presentation together. With our work, reading, thinking, counting, and observation don't always precede doing. Nonetheless, we want to tell you, our listeners, a good story about what we have been up to. So we're going to unfold 8 episodes in the series, and listeners will likely pick up on a trajectory of discussion and project making that runs from Indigenous knowledge to storytelling, then to games and planting, and eventually to intentional satire and parody. And finally, with ideas about public display and looking at where we're going, that is, the future, we do wrap up the series. Sheena, now I think it would be helpful for you to give us some of the backstory to SEF. How did it come into existence? What were some of the key concepts and strategies and hopes from the start? And anything else you think listeners might need to know in order to begin this journey with a sense of what they're getting themselves into?
Thanks, Patrick. Yeah. Well, one of the questions that I'm asked quite a lot when people see us animating, you know, the various exhibitions or the final exhibition in a box, the Flux Kit for Energy Transition, is how we built this big team that then managed to work together so well over what became at this point 7 years, right? Because COVID interrupted the project and it took a lot longer than initially anticipated. So, you know, how did we choose who was going to be part of the project? How did we create the mini teams on the project where people had their own lines of inquiry and their own investigations and outputs they were working on? And what listeners are going to hear today is a conversation that you and Natalie and I had a couple of years back now And we talk a bit about that in the episode, but I think that how we did that is a bit, part serendipity, part planning, and part surprise. The most important thing was that we were running a project relationally. And so we set out from the beginning to run a project in good relation with the communities that we would be working with and to create a community amongst ourselves. And for me, from the get-go, I was very clear that I wanted to develop a clear intersectional leadership style that would push back against many of the institutional violences that make our lives difficult inside the academy and make it difficult for people to be part of the academy when they find themselves outside the academy. And I was very open about the fact that I didn't really know what that meant, but that I was working on that. And so, I mean, how we chose team members was based on a number of, clearly planned strategies. We needed people from across the disciplines because part of this was about creating interdisciplinary knowledge, right? So we needed people, with Cree knowledges, with knowledge from other Indigenous cultures, from knowledges from a range of immigrant, refugee, and settler cultures. And we wanted researchers with, technical skills from all sorts of disciplines, whether that was, artistic skills, the skills of energy humanists, policymaking skills, Indigenous legal expertise, AI skills, working with augmented reality or virtual reality. And then we wanted the scientists and engineers with their technical skills as well. So that was planned, right? But what we really also selected for was to find colleagues that were open to interdisciplinary work, right? That were going to be respectful of knowledge holders from across the disciplines and a range of communities. We wanted to work in a way that didn't privilege one discipline over another, that recognized all these disciplines were important. All the community knowledges were also equally valid and important. And so, that takes a certain kind of willingness to be open, respectful, and listen. And it also requires, in the way that we were planning the project, that people be okay with giving up individual authorial credit, which can be very important. It's one of the things we trade in the academy. But there really is no such thing as knowledge being created in a vacuum. There's no solitary genius. All knowledge is created in community and in conversation with other people. And so we wanted people that were going to be willing to recognize that, work in that way, and, produce outputs that had multiple authors on it. And that meant giving up some of their own, authority, control, and other things. So that's how we got started. And of course, the team shifted and morphed slightly, and people stepped on or off for professional reasons. I mean, some people got jobs and promotions or big grants of their own and couldn't commit the time. And sometimes we noticed that there were gaps and we needed to invite someone else on. And so we did that. But you'll hear a lot of people refer to the first time we met in Banff, but it wasn't actually the first time. Looking back, however, I think it was the point in the project at which really our team had coalesced. So that's one way, I suppose, of sort of saying how we picked everybody and how we built this team and working relationally and really truly building friendships and respect and a community is how we have lasted for 7 years. And, there's lifelong friendships on this project at this point.
That was great, Sheena. I think it's a really helpful way to help all of us, including me, who's only been around for the team-related part of this project, understand how this project moved from your desk and your research program in other contexts to the kind of team-related work that we've been doing. And of course, all of that took a lot of planning to engage so many people on so many levels with so many ideas and methodologies. And we started that in 2017. And then, of course, we initiated this podcast in 2023. So there have been a lot of moving parts that required planning. What we couldn't have planned for, as we both know, is COVID and its aftermath, which are certainly part of the backdrop to SEF. Not to mention that much of our work was developed and even completed before Trump was elected. And of course, we might ask questions about whether we would have done everything in the way we did. But of course, I think that raises the fact that the kinds of realities that we're dealing with when we deal with a contemporary project, such as speculative energy futures, requires us to be nimble. Another way to articulate it might be that this is a contemporary project that was meant to address real-world challenges in real time. And so with COVID and the American political context not mapping directly onto our central preoccupation with energy transition, we still recognize that there was a need to adapt our work because we wanted to carry on against those backdrops, demonstrating the urgency of energy transition, even in the kind of changing context in relation to which we have been observing the world. I think at this point, it would be useful for our listeners to get a concrete idea about what we've been up to. We've produced a lot as a team over the course of the project. And I'm going to ask you if you could just help us kind of review some of the kinds of things that we've been doing.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. I really like that word nimble that you used because, I mean, one of the things that we talked about a lot as a team is just the way you need to be nimble and agile to be adaptive, responsive, resilient in the face of a constantly changing climate and environment. And Trump and COVID are all part of that constantly shifting environment and the kinds of violences that increasingly fascist governments around the world are enacting are all part of a fear response to climate change. And they're a part of people facing end of times and hunkering down so they can sort of, you know, go to Mars or, you know, buy islands or whatever it is that they're planning. I wouldn't advise buying any islands. The water level's rising. But in terms of outputs, though, in terms of actual outputs, so when we set out at the beginning, we thought one of our criteria was we need not only great artists, but we need artists capable of producing really large scale, high impact art that would be a way for us to communicate and share the research that, you know, interdisciplinary teams had created. And that's how we started out, right? In 2018, we had a big team meeting over several days. It was kind of like a real orientation to the project. In 2019, we went to Banff and did something similar and started working on sub-teams. And by 2019, in December, we had a large-scale exhibition at the Fine Arts Building, the Fab Gallery at the University of Alberta. And that exhibition was called Prototypes for Possible Worlds. And we couldn't know at that time that, you know, less than 3 months later, we would be locked down in March. And we, you know, for COVID-19, and we didn't know how long that would go on for. And in that time, we had to create some responses. You know, at first, we talk about this in one of the episodes, but we didn't know exactly how long that would last. So we started shifting how we worked together and how we could work together online and still create a community of research online. And that led to when COVID lightened up and some of the restrictions had lightened up and we were coming out of that moment. In 2022, we went to St. Gallen, Switzerland to teach a course called Pathways for Climate Justice. And that was also accompanied by kind of a large scale exhibition called Unpacking Energy Transition, Flux Kit Beta Tests. And then in the spring of 2023, we had a bunch of conversations that you'll hear parts of in this podcast. And between 2023 and now, and very soon we'll be finishing up, we've been busy publishing pieces of what now will become part of a Flux Kit for Energy Transition that is an exhibition in a box that can move through the world. People can write to us and we can mail it to them and they can activate it in classrooms, policy spaces, communities, you know, communities of activists, communities of all kinds of people trying to think through climate change. And we'll talk about all of those pieces of the kit, but, you know, just to give you a flavor for that, some of the, at least two pieces of the kit have been published as actual books that you can buy that are out on the market now. We have We Were In It, which is a collection of short stories, and we have the Energy Emergency Repair Kit, which is published with Fordham Press. And so we're going to talk a lot about the Flux Kit for Energy Transition and that, you know, that desire to shrink everything that was huge scale exhibition size down into a box that really came out of that COVID moment. And so we've been thinking about this podcast and putting it together for the last couple of years as we finish up all those pieces. And you can find a lot of this information on the Just Powers website. You can click onto these various projects like Prototypes for Possible Worlds or Unpacking Energy Transition Flux Kit Beta Tests, or we have an actual Flux Kit, Speculative Energy Futures Flux Kit site where you can open and unpack virtually online the exhibition in a box. So that is some of what we've been up to. And yeah, and one thing that I would add about both the large scale exhibitions that we hosted and the Flux Kit for Energy Transition is that they all have a call to action in them. And so in some ways, this is a moment of transition. Some people might say the project is ending because we're, you know, finishing up the exhibition in a box and the books are coming out. But also it's the beginning of a new phase of research. And because we hope that the Flux Kit for Energy Transition will be activated by, you know, all of you listening to this podcast in your communities, maybe in your classrooms. And we hope that the kit has a long half-life as it's both the culmination of our collaborative interdisciplinary team research efforts, and also it's a way to provoke and make change moving forward.
Thanks, Sheena. That's really a great way for us to kind of summarize some of the kinds of things that we've been about for this extended period, which has been so exciting. Before we turn to our conversation with Natalie to enlarge on the beginnings of this project, I think it would be helpful if you could help us understand what this term energy transition, what it means, what it's doing. I think in some sense, probably most people have a sense of the kind of change that energy transition represents, but I think your understanding of it has a level of depth that I certainly don't necessarily have access to, and many of our listeners might not either. So if you could just talk a little bit about the term, that would be great.
I mean, energy transition, as I've written about elsewhere, has been for me a very important focus in the climate crisis because, you know, as Timothy Morton talks about, climate change is this huge hyper object. It's unwieldy. People don't know how to access it. And certainly where I live and even where we live, Patrick, even in all of Canada, but especially in Alberta, especially here in Edmonton, the gateway to the north, where we have the tar sands just north of us here, certainly oil and energy transition are things that are in the news every day. And, you know, I started researching these things around 2005, 2006, and I would say that in the time between 2005 and now, which I guess thinking about it has been 20 years, energy transition has become a common phrase. You turn on the radio, you drive anywhere, you're hearing stories about energy transition. Part of that is the Paris agreements in 2015, 2016, the Paris Agreement. There was a decision that we would try to keep global heating below a certain degree. And the parts per million of carbon in the air matters as one of the major greenhouse gases. And so we started to see things like carbon budgets and measuring of carbon and measuring of the parts per million of carbon in the air. And so energy transition is not only an important measure for where we're at in the climate change transformation and in the fight against climate change, or the lack of fight against climate change, it's also one thing that we can grab onto in this huge, complex, like, system of climate change and say, you can focus on energy transition. There's lots of money, frankly. I've written about it elsewhere. It's not a secret that I've considered it a kind of hack. There's a lot of money that went into energy transition. And so it was possible to mobilize that money for energy transition to make change. And importantly for me, I came to this through the study of human rights issues, and I was worried about climate justice, and energy transition became a place to have that conversation about climate justice for the last 20 years. You know, I have started moving into other spheres of influence around, you know, community health and well-being and the interconnection and interdependence of you know, ecological health and human health, but energy transition will never not be part of that. So I think that energy transition is a first critical step in decarbonizing the environment. You know, as I said, with the international agreements, it's a material problem. We can address it in steps and we can imagine it incrementally. And I think this is one of the really big issues with climate change. Like, how do you deal with something so large? And also societies are shaped by the energy systems that power them. So if we're going to remake energy systems, that means, you know, inherently we're remaking power relations. And that is why people are very unnerved by the energy transition, especially where I am. But it also means that there are some opportunities there to create more climate justice and more healthy and well societies, depending on who gets to be part of those conversations. So that's how I think of energy transition. And I hope that's the way the team thinks about it now, having had, you know, 7 years of conversation, that these are ways that we think about energy transition as one of many potential entry points into a conversation about climate change, but also about climate justice and social well-being and planetary health.
That's great, Sheena. And it does bring to mind something that our listeners and I perhaps will want to keep in mind as we're listening to the podcast. And that has to do with a kind of implication or implied notion that maybe we all need to, could we call it, do science? I mean, you're coming from a humanities background, but maybe we are all needing to kind of, in a sense, adopt and integrate some of the language and the thinking that science brings to us into our daily lives. Or maybe it's that science needs to make itself more available to us. And so this seems to be a kind of conundrum that maybe we're going to be working with throughout the podcast.
Oh, don't get me started, Patrick. This is a question that I love, because I mean, basically another thing that I argue is that the real issue, like, climate change is just a symptom. It's not the real issue. The real issue are these epistemic problems. And part of that problem is like Western enlightenment and the scientific revolution and how it took certain pieces of knowledge and declared those reasonable and rational, and how it excised many other kinds of knowledge as knowledge is held by women, knowledge is held by people that have, you know, people of color. So all of those knowledges were excised. And so for me, this energy transition or response to climate change is really about bringing all those knowledges back in, recovering them where we can, reinventing them where they don't exist, because hello, we've never lived through this before. So there's no sense pretending that we have all the solutions. So we just need to uncover some magical historical knowledge that we lost. We don't necessarily have the knowledges we need right now. And we need to work together in conversation, respecting each other's knowledges equally, and really listening to what we know and what we experientially know too. You know, Albert Einstein said, all knowledge begins as experience. And I think we're all living through climate change and we all have something to say about it and we all have something to contribute to it. And so it's about really building that respect and understanding that these epistemic issues are part of the problem. And we all need to be involved in science and defining science and accessing science and having different sciences talk to each other. You know, there are different scientific modalities, and it can be hard to talk across them, as we learned on speculative energy futures with our, you know, various scientists on the project who have trouble talking to other kinds of scientists, right? So there is no problem more unwieldy than climate change, and we all have to learn to talk to each other across all of our differences.
And with that, I think we should go to our conversation. I think Natalie will definitely have some things to help enlarge on what I think we've begun here. So here we go. Let's introduce Speculative Energy Futures to our listeners. I guess really the question is, what is it and why? And tell us a little bit about why artists and researchers and energy transition fit together. Natalie, do you want to start us off?
So we were doing a series together that was thinking about feminist politics of the maternal and climate change. And, you know, over the course of working together, one of the ways that I remember this is we decided that we wanted to work on something that really focused more specifically on energy transition, which is the kind of area of research that you'd been in for quite a while since you started Petrocultures. It's a project that brings together literacies from Sheena's background and my background. And I feel like I'll get into the weeds right away. I get into the weeds right away trying to think about what is it, right? Because really quite simply, it's a collaborative project with a bunch of people coming together to teach and learn about how we adapt to climate crisis in nimble, social, local, and national ways. And that takes seriously the proposition that the kind of technologies that are being worked on right now in many a lab worldwide aren't going to be ready in time.
That's true. One of my learnings on this project is that any solution that's in the research and development phase right now is probably 8 years from being on the market. So we can't wait for yet another decade to implement some of those solutions. We can implement them in 10 years if we're already taking action on the solutions we have, but we can't always keep waiting for a better solution. So we need to figure out not only a way forward, but we need to figure out what we know and what we don't know. And so it's about working in interdisciplinary and collaborative ways and having people with different perspectives bring their ideas to the table and their skills to the table. And that in itself is a way to create new knowledge. So we did a lot of that using research creation methods and practices. And using research creation also allowed us to honor everyone's disciplinary expertise and activist sensibilities and desires for the future and knowledges about the future. So that's another way to explain it, I guess.
When you mention research creation and we're thinking about teams and interdisciplinarity, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the plan was. Was there a plan that you would have one artist on every team and one policy person? You know, how did we form, if you will?
You know, one of the ways that Sheena and I came together around this, and it's not simply this, because we'd already been collaborating for quite a while, but if we take Sheena as an energy transition expert and we take me as a research creation expert and mash us up, those are two of the literacies, of the many literacies that are part of the project. Too often when we go into collaborative projects in university spaces, what is expected is that your area of expertise and my area of expertise will mash up and we will be able to kind of produce, you know, A, B from A and B, instead of having A and B come together and open-endedly, you know, open up to X, Y, and Z, right? And so taking away the need to immediately predict what the outcome will be and what the value of the work will be is, you know, it's one of the things that I think is really important about this project. And partially that was, you know, developed by, you know, letting everyone come together and say, hey, I want to work with you. I don't know what I want to work on yet. Hey, I want to work with you because I don't know, like you're making my brain tingle or you said this really weird thing over in that conversation over there. And I think, you know, I hadn't thought about things that way. And maybe if we talk together, we'll kind of think some new thoughts together. And, you know, in the university, having a path not delimited ahead of time is something that is increasingly rare. And it takes vulnerability and it takes a leap of faith. And so the simple answer to your question, Patrick, is no, there wasn't an artist and a scientist on each team or anything like that. You know, folks were invited to mash up and collaborate with whoever they wanted to. And that choice making was based on what they were curious about, what they wanted to think about.
Dare I say that it was also sometimes because we said, go make a zine, you have 1 hour. And you were standing next to somebody and then suddenly you were working with them for 5 years because you had to come back to the room with something produced. So there were elements of fun and play also in how things were done. Yeah. Because if we waited to find all our synergies, that might not have happened. And I would just add to that,
that's true.
You know, there was a real drive to run this with what I was calling at the time sort of a feminist leadership style. But I was also quite explicit about the fact that I had no idea what that meant. Right. But part of it was lateral leadership, letting people make their own decisions. There is no denying that research is a creative endeavor, and to pretend that it's not and that it's always full of rigor and objectivity is just, you know, a performance of sorts that isn't genuine to what actually goes on.
So I'm enjoying hearing about and being reminded of the formation of the teams and how we thought about that in relation to interdisciplinarity and research creation. But I'm also aware, Sheena, that many of us came to the table without a lot of background with petrocultures and energy transition. And on the other hand, you yourself have a fair amount of engagement and involvement in those areas. And so I wonder, you know, what your thoughts and expectations were around bringing us together. There was a degree to which we needed to kind of up our game in terms of our knowledge set. And at the same time, there's a certain amount of I could refer to myself and say, somewhat naive curiosity about how I might find a way into this kind of work. So maybe you could riff on some of that for a minute.
In some ways, it goes back to the previous question that you asked Natalie about curating the teams. Well, we didn't curate the sub-teams, but we did curate the big team. And, you know, Natalie was very clear that we need a number of strong artists that were capable of producing impactful work. And, you know, we needed a couple of people at least who understood some of the basics of petrocultures. But also, what we wanted to do, what I really wanted to do, what we were trying to do with the Feminist Maternal Anthropocene Project was to get people who are loosely interested in these topics, caring more about them, understanding more about them, because you can't create a movement and you can't create a transition without a lot of people doing that kind of work. And, you know, I had that idea from the beginning to just really get other people involved and passionate. I talked to my students about how everybody needs to bring what they've got to this challenge. And then I spent a whole semester talking to them about what energy transition is and all the different ways that you can become involved and bring your different skills to it. But I've become even more convinced over time that that's really necessary as I read about, you know, one of my wagers is that really climate change is just a symptom, and that the real problem is an epistemological failure, and that comes out of the Enlightenment and colonization and a very narrow worldview in which only certain ideas were privileged. And that is the argument that we brought into the project, that we needed to have multiple perspectives and multiple points of view. But also, as I do research, historical research, I realize how many times those knowledges have been erased intentionally. And the reason they get erased is because they're maybe a bit too wacky for the, I don't know, conventional wisdom or what's happening in society. So what you need is a lot of people saying those things so that it doesn't get erased, right? Because lots of great people already said these things. A lot of what we're just saying has been said before, but now we're saying it in relationship to energy transition. And we just have to get enough people saying it that it can become part of the conventional wisdom for how to move forward.
I remember that those beginning meetings. And I have to say, Sheena, so like if I can characterize it, at the beginning, the vast majority of the people in the room understood themselves as aligned with climate justice in one way or another. But the distinction energy transition, as in your words, a first material step, right, a place to ground climate justice, that wasn't part of most of our literacies, right? And so what I am present to right now, hearing you respond to Patrick and also remembering the event in St. Gallen recently, and having been in conversation with various team members over the last, how many years has it been? Right? Five? I'm like, oh, wow. I bet you if we did interviews with everyone now and said, hey, do you remember that first workshop in Banff when, you know, we were just starting to think about energy transition and research creation for folks with a love for, like, if you measure the space from there to here, like, I think, you know, everybody is now drunk the Sheena Kool-Aid. There's no question. Everyone's like, oh, of course, energy transition, right? Whereas when we started, it was, well, oh, okay, but that sounds a little, you know, scientific or technological or macro policy, right? So what is, like, how do we grasp onto that in terms of our lived daily material realities and our local modes of organizing, et cetera, you know, from, you know, challenging kind of the individuality and the replication of the nuclear family home, right? Which says we all have to have one of everything. Therefore, we have to make a gazillion of everything, you know, versus different kind of food sharing and tool sharing and car sharing modes, and just you really opened up the world of energy transition so that we could think of it, you know, at all scales. Right. And I think that's where research creation also comes in really interestingly, because, you know, as a, arguably a methodology, an approach that centers artistic knowledge production, creative knowledge production, and artistic outputs that are experiential and participatory in nature, right? It invites everybody to think through, well, sure, we want governments to do this. Sure, we want these kind of large-scale global actions. But what can we do here on the ground? Where can we get some traction so that we're not simply in face of overwhelm and a sense of a lack of agency? And so, you know, I think the kind of community-building aspect of the project is something that, we haven't talked about a lot, but I really feel like that is something that the 5 years and what it'll be 7 years in the end, like that amount of time has really allowed a series of sub-communities and a larger community to develop in ways that wasn't possible on Immunations, which only went for 3 years, right? And I remember we got to the end of that project, and I don't know if you remember this, Patrick, but when I did the exit interviews, almost everybody said, now we can start. Like, now we feel like we have a kind of collective momentum that we could start to do something real.
As you're speaking, Natalie, I'm also resonating with, well, the word community, but also thinking about audience. And, you know, as you're both talking, I'm thinking, yeah, when you have this kind of, we'll call it a sort of multimodal or heterogeneous approach to a project, I think you allow a whole range of people various ways in. So I think that that can be really exciting and generative. And I do have the sense that, you know, we probably have been reaching people that might not have expected to be interested in energy transition. But I'm also thinking about the challenges. And I don't know if this is one you want to take up, Sheena. You know, is it possible that the project might not seem insistent enough for certain activists, we'll say, or maybe it's not overtly scientific enough? You know, what are the sort of pitfalls of working in a way that does bring both expert knowledge and expert creativity together with, you know, some fairly sort of unschooled ways of thinking and working as well?
I think there are people who will find it hard to understand why it's useful to have a flux kit for energy transition. Maybe they'll understand it better if they are open to experimenting with it. But also as a pedagogical tool, it's useful, and it's also important that some of the team members didn't know very much about energy transition when they started, because as a pedagogical tool, it can help start those conversations in communities where either people don't know very much about it or they don't know very much about energy transition as a social issue, which is what we know that we need to do. You know, the social action on climate is what we can really do right now with the technologies we have. And there's not a lot of money invested in that. This was an investment in that. It's about getting those conversations going. And so I could imagine taking the kit or taking different pieces of the kit to my energy transition and climate resilience advisory committee that advises city council. And there's a lot of very highly skilled, very technical experts on that team around energy transition, but it would give them some new ways to think about energy transition, and it would allow a conversation so that we could learn from one another's expertise in the room. Because we do sort of right now talking about policy. Of course, it's a very interesting learning experience, but we would learn different things and engage with one another in different kinds of ways if we were mobilizing the kit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're making me think about how the difference between, on the one hand, so energy transition, those are the terms of engagement for what we're doing. But one of the things that I've learned most through the project is about energy embeddedness and energy reliance, right? So first, the one of the pedagogical aspects of the kit, I think, is that many of the projects invite us to uncover, think through, and understand our own energy embeddedness and reliances. That is, you know, denaturalizing them so we can actually think about them and see them in order to open up a space for a conversation, a robust conversation about energy transition that isn't simply how do we survive this life this way by switching from, you know, oil to whatever, solar or whatever. When you first introduced this project to me, Sheena, one of the things you said over and over again was energy transition is social, right? And we aren't going to, what's another wonderful Sheena-ism? We aren't going to die of a lack of energy, but of a lack of the imagination. And so what I hear you saying about bringing the kit to, say, you know, the Edmonton, to city council or the climate committee, what I hear you saying is actually this becomes a tool for folks with a lot of, you know, really deeply invested local knowledge in kind of science and policy. And it can invite them to ask themselves again, like how they understand like the solutions. And again, you know, what problems we're solving for, which is another, sorry, I'm on the roll with Sheena-isms right now. But like, you know, if, you know, that is, you know, what problem are we solving for? Because there are lots of assumptions.
You know, what we talk about is the epistemological crisis, the epistemological failures of this moment. And we need to be able to come back at a problem from a different perspective and have new ideas about it because we have a different way of seeing it through another epistemological system, through another cultural worldview, through another discipline. And when we see things in new ways, it means we also have to let go of being an expert, of always looking at it from our expertise, our perspective. And we can't hang on to our ego. So being agile and responsive and nimble to climate change is about letting go of your ego, about not hanging on to the kinds of heteronormative, patriarchal, cisgendered ways of understanding the world that we've all integrated and that are part of the problem of thinking there is a genius that's going to come up with a solution to solve all of this. And we're waiting for someone else to do it because, you know, we all have to do this and we have to do it together. And that means, you know, sharing what we know and listening to others who know things we don't.
What both of you are saying is really helping me to kind of formulate a thought around what was our purpose, but also the fact that oftentimes when artists work, they work with an intention, which is maybe even something like a hunch, a sense that something needs to be done, but they wouldn't be able to say what their specific purpose was until they had really sort of unfolded a project. So my sense is that, you know, we really did as a group, we unpacked a number of ways of approaching this vast problem and challenge. And it became purposeful, but in imaginative ways that we might not have otherwise anticipated had we thought we had to write them down in advance. So I guess I want to ask you both, in anticipation of our series here and the kinds of things people are going to hear when they tune in, was there anything that really surprised you about things that we did, aspects of the project that we did? You know, and maybe it's a big thing, maybe it's a small thing. But I know I myself, you know, when I approach art, when I approach cultural projects, I really want to be surprised or I want to be set back on my heels a little bit because I may be discovering something that I had no anticipation of finding out. So any thoughts on surprise?
So I will say, one, you were just talking about the epistemological problem. And as you were saying that, I was thinking about in speculative energy futures and these kinds of projects, you know, I think of Karen Barad's epistemontology framework that, you know, insists that ontology and epistemology are imbricated. And I think that that's something that is really relevant to the project in the sense that it's our worldviews and our ideologies and our understandings of the world and also our lived experience. And so, you know, one surprise for me is the surprise that came out of COVID. Basically, we had planned to do something that kind of continued in the vein of prototypes, the exhibition we did before COVID hit. And, you know, the plan was to create kind of large-scale events at various places, at COP, in Ottawa, somewhere, you know, look for venues to bring people together in exhibition-type spaces to have experiences and conversations about climate change, climate justice, energy transition, feminism, decolonization, local action, et cetera. And then COVID, right? And that the pivot to the Flux Kit, right, was something that really emerged from, as I remember it, all of us sitting together and saying, okay, well, how do we keep going, right? How do we keep going in the face of these new material isolation conditions? And, you know, what I love about the Flux Kit is that I don't think we would have gotten there without COVID. And yet it is so perfect, right? It is a nimble, in principle, a nimble, low-cost, movable invitation kit to unpack, and an invitation to think through energy transition in multiple different ways to inspire new lines of flight and conversation and imagination and, you know, critical consciousness raising. And to bring it back full loop, it's the necessarily experiential nature of the Flux Kit.
Natalie, for people who don't know what a Flux Kit is, can we get a little bit more specific about what it is? What would people encounter that isn't an art gallery that is going to engage them?
Sure. Well, you can also jump in on this, Patrick, but I'll say, so the term comes from some productions that were part of a group of artists in the kind of mid-20th century that were organized under the name Fluxus. You can get a little waffly trying to describe them because they very purposefully said, we're not a movement, we're not a cohesive thing, we are a kind of, you know, a network of artists who are interested in creating work that was non-hierarchical, non-high art, that had an activist perspective, and attempted to engage in social change did it through mobilizing lots of different forms that were grounded in play. And one of the forms was a flux kit in a suitcase. It was a mobile pop-up museum, really, a mobile pop-up event with lots of different elements. And it was designed to kind of, you know, circulate and create new conversations about the category of art and what it was and could be.
Sheena, were you surprised at the Flux Kit as a solution to our situation?
I was surprised by a global pandemic. We spent a lot of time scrambling, and I was recently explaining to somebody, you know, that we did land on the Flux Kit, but it wasn't quite that easy. There were a number of experiments before that. If you remember, we had the workshop with the Yes Men, and you know, we had writing workshops. We didn't know how long. I mean, everybody knows this, but we sometimes have to remind ourselves we didn't know how long it would last. So there was a kind of like, can we outlast this and just wait and pick up what we're doing? You know, and then Natalie did have this idea about the Flux Kit, and that will be one of our major outputs. And it's worked extremely well because people were able to build different pieces of the projects they were working on at a distance, right? Mm-hmm. And bring them all together.
You're just reminding me, the other kind of obvious fact is its distributed nature, right? The sense that, you know, we didn't know how long this was going to go on. And so there was a possibility here of something circulating through the mail without our bodies, and that other people could animate it in other places. And so that is a completely different mode of circulation that isn't, you know, it isn't new to this, but became necessary because of the pandemic.
Yeah. And the Flux Kit too is a really important output of the project, but it's not the only output. I mean, right before COVID hit, we had just had an exhibition in a gallery, and many of those pieces, I mean, I think that what you proposed to people was, is the installation you put in the gallery complete? And have you thought all the thoughts you want to think about that and move on? Or are there still things you want to work on and make it part of the Flux Kit? So some items in the Flux Kit are further developments of earlier installations in a physical big art gallery space. And some of them are brand new and were specifically for that COVID moment. So that was, you know, that's one thing. And also, you know, when you asked me that question earlier about whether it was too far from energy transition for some people, and I was a little worried about how funders would receive this. The other thing is that, you know, these tangible works that we've built as a team are products of speculative energy futures, but so too are the many books that are being written by the various members of the team, the collaboratively written book that we're working on now for speculative energy futures that will talk about all of these different projects and the ones that came before and other plans. And, you know, some of the pieces in the kit, just to give you an idea, there are games in the kit, little card and dice games. That's the scores one that
Natalie and Scott worked on, but there's also, you know, a literary collection. We were in it as a literary collection under review with the University Press as a research creation piece. There's the Planet for Sale book, which we hope will become a trade book. And then there's an art book version in the kit. You know, there's the fortune telling piece. There's the, you know, I mean, I love banners. It's so sophisticated in the box, but also the ideas and quite complicated, but the idea is really quite simple. You know, make a banner and put it up in your community on the side of one of those, you know, truck trailers that they have in the farmer's fields or on a billboard in town and find a way to do that. And, you know, we did a little research on how complicated that can be because of who owns the billboards and who owns media. But, you know, these are interesting things we learned, and I can't talk about all of them here. You'll hear about them over the period of the podcast, but each item in the box is not just there to observe and play with. It comes with a provocation, right? To move it forward, to move it into community and to make something happen in the world. Yeah.
It's a call to action.
Absolutely. And I was also thinking of the word translation. And in essence, you know, I think that when we first got together, there was the need to sort of translate from what we might call artist languages to scientists' languages, all that kind of thing. And then with the dawn of the pandemic, there was the need to translate some of our ideas into something both more portable and also, you could say, that, you know, might have minimized our carbon footprint a little bit more, all of that sort of thing. So I guess I am, as an artist, always interested in the fact that we're involved in translation. And I think that in essence, a project like this really shows us that if we're going to be kind of interacting with a range of communities, we're going to need to adapt our languages and our ways of thinking about audience, which we've been talking about a little bit. So I'll just throw that in. I'm wondering if there's any kind of big learnings we want to talk about here, things we might not have touched on. That would be one thing. And also, are there things that we can sort of anticipate for our listeners about, you know, what they may be hearing and who they might be meeting? I haven't really mentioned all the members of the team, and they'll be joining us throughout the podcast. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what's up ahead, as it were.
I have my biggest learning from the whole project, my biggest moment of learning maybe, and that was that, you know, we had this great title, Speculative Energy Futures, you know, and we were playing with this idea of speculation, the idea of modeling, scientists do it, you know, we were going to do it too, we were going to do it in collaboration with scientists, and then we had the first workshop in Banff, and you were there for that moment, I think, Patrick, you, me, and Janice were talking, and she said, well, I don't really understand what we're supposed to do because in Cree ways of knowing, we don't speculate. We have prophecies. And I was like, gulp, my whole title doesn't work now. That's just a small example of the ways that, like, from that moment on, everything we did in the project, I saw from a new perspective and it shifted the way that I saw things. And I was able to see my own narrow-minded ways of thinking. I mean, the idea had been like, let's use our imagination, let's be speculative, let's approach this from different perspectives. But even in the way I named that, my own worldview was very clear. So that was a really big learning.
Thinking of links between the project and other works that I'm engaged in now, and seeing, you know, as we always do when we kind of look back at a certain moment, how what seems to be a set of new thoughts really emerges from something else that you've already been engaged in together. And so, you know, in terms of the greatest lessons, I think, you know, one of the, and this is prompted by what you were saying, Patrick, about translation and the kind of multimodal research creational way that we are working on the project. And, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot recently is, you know, how to do social and ecological justice work in our university spaces and our cultural spaces, museum spaces, in a moment where what I see a lot of is tokenism and virtue signaling and cancel culture and calling out. And there's a lot of, you know, fear around, you know, misgendering, misappropriating, misattributing, right? And it just occurred to me that, you know, one of the things that we all realized early on with this project is that having climate change, like we're in Alberta, you know, where there's an oil loyal narrative where the entire institution is fully dependent on oil. And we're doing this work here, and this is something that you write about, Sheena, in terms of coming from a family embedded in the oil industry in various ways, how we need to call each other in and up and not out, and have conversations across different sets of concerns. Like, I need to feed my family. I'm not going to quit my job on the oil rig, right? How do we have energy transition and climate justice conversations, not just in the kind of activist crowd, following Greta, but, with folks who are like, yeah, I mean, I need to feed my family, right? How do we have those conversations and bring people in? And I think the kit does that really well has the potential to do that really well, because it has so many different ways in, and it has so much kind of, invitation to think creatively and so I guess many, many different ways of getting into the question, right? If I think about the kit as more than anything else, a dialogic prompt, like grab this kit, be at your family dinner, grab this kit, be in the classroom, grab this kit, be with city council, and open it up and let people choose, because there isn't a particular order that you're supposed to go through, right? You open it up, you see what strikes your fancy, try this. That doesn't strike your fancy, fine, put it down, let's try this one, right? So I think that dialogic strategy of open-endedness and creating room for lots of different perspectives and voices is something that is a big takeaway for me on this project. And it's not a new takeaway in the sense of, my kind of thoughts and commitments when it comes to political action, but to see how well the Flux Kit has the potential of embodying that is something that I hadn't really thought about before this conversation.
The thing that I think about in that regard too is, and it's a big, big kind of moniker for something you're talking about, but it feels really non-hierarchical. And by that, I mean that, there were so many of us involved in it, and there were others from outside the project, the students, the printmaking students at the U of A. And so even with that banners, that billboard project, its title came from one of the students' works, which was a billboard that was designed to say, "This can't wait." And so I think that the thing that I'm really happy about with a project like this is that it seems that built within its kind of ethos and its infrastructures are some systems and approaches, and Sheena, you've referred to feminist thought and feminist action. I think we have done fairly well at manifesting some of that, and so that to me is one of the things that I hope we can sort of emphasize throughout these podcasts, that it was coming out of conversation, and so now we want to have some conversations about what we did and why, why it was so important to us to do that. But we think that it's also important for other people to have access to it through our Flux Kit and our various projects.
Very well said, Patrick. I think that's a great summary of what we're up to in this podcast, is just talking about what we've been up to and what we hope the kit will get up to, and maybe some of us as we take it around the world or send it to any of the listeners in their locations where they can mobilize it in their spaces and in their communities with their friends and loved ones. So yeah, I'm looking forward to all the conversations we'll be having over the next few episodes.
Great. Well, thank you both. It's such fun to be able to get together and begin to have these conversations. And we really look forward to welcoming people into the conversation and giving them some cues as to where they can go to learn more about speculative energy futures and also the availability of our Flux Kit, et cetera, et cetera.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Thanks,
thank
Patrick.
You. Thanks, Patrick. This was great. Yeah. Thanks, Natalie,
thank
for being
you,
here.
Well, that seemed to be a great way to introduce the Reflector series. And it was really great to hear from you, Sheena, as the principal investigator of the project, and from Natalie, who is really leading the charge regarding the way we think about art and helping all of us to kind of integrate art thinking and research creation into the project. Before we let our listeners in on what the topics or what the preoccupations of the forthcoming episodes are going to be, there was a couple of things that came up that I thought I would perhaps turn to you and ask you to maybe open up for us a little bit further. At one point, Natalie refers to energy embeddedness. And Sheena, I wonder if you could help us with that term, just sort of how to think about it.
Right. I think when she's talking about energy embeddedness, she's talking about kind of my positionality and, you know, who I am relative to, you know, oil and the oil industrial complex and my family and things. We are all living on this planet right now, and this is a global problem. And so nobody is outside of the problem. So the notion of scientific objectivity is really complicated if you're trying to objectively deal with this, because no one is entirely objective about this. And people, oil and energy are deeply integrated into how we live, right? They are foundational to how our societies form and organize, right?
Yeah, that's really helpful. One of the other things that I think came up in this conversation was your question that I think we'll hear you raise throughout the episodes, and that is, are we working to solve the right problem? That seems to be a key question for defining and re-articulating the understanding of the path we're on. Do you want to add anything to that?
There's a lot of questions or problems that we're solving for that, to me, do not seem to be the problems that will get us to the cause of the crises and the intersecting crises and the polycrisis this century, right? They will solve small issues. They're kind of like band-aid solutions, but they're not getting to the root causes of the polycrisis. So yeah, that is true. That is one of my major preoccupations.
Yes, and I think that relates to maybe the appropriateness of artists being involved in this project and people trying to work with creative approaches. And I think I referred to this a little bit in our conversation, but, you know, as an artist, I don't necessarily have a 5-year plan. I don't necessarily have a highly crafted sort of set of to-dos, but I do have intention. I think artists have intention, and they often move into solving a problem in part with a hunch and in part through process. And so I think a speculative energy futures also does some of that. You know, our groups really get together and start to kind of mull over not only the larger questions around energy transition, but also, you know, the meta questions or the smaller preoccupations, to use that word again, and as a way into actually thinking in embodied ways and in ways that I think really help us see the problem and also potential solutions in more vivid and sometimes more, ways that are more kind of true to the way we live our lives. So I think that question or that idea of solving for the right question and the way artists work, I think that's those things really come together. I guess the last thing I'll say before we just sort of look at what we're going to be dealing with in the future episodes is that one of our outcomes from our whole project is a flux kit. And I know as an artist, I should just say what that is, but I wonder if you could maybe say something about how we came to a flux kit as a solution to the need to manifest some of our results.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of the episode, what did we plan to do and what did we really do? Well, I guess, you know, we did not plan to make a flux kit at the outset. We definitely planned huge, large scale exhibitions and we budgeted for all of that. And then, as we mentioned in the episode, COVID happened and we tried a lot of experiments and the flux kit really provided a solution. And, you know, the interesting thing about the flux kit is that we decided there were certain criteria, you know, we had to have some kind of creative limits. And one of the creative limits was that every single item, every small piece in the flux kit must also have a prompt or an activation so that if people are engaging with it, then they're given a task to do or they're empowered to go out and do some kind of climate action. And so in many ways, it's a really interesting wrap up for the project because it's also the beginning of the next stage of the project, right? I find myself now as we're wrapping things up and finalizing it and taking pictures of it. Well, now I'm really excited about like, well, do we put a thing on the webpage so people can give us feedback? Because now the flux kit starts to go out into the world. And yes, we've taken it places and we've exhibited it large scale in Switzerland, for example, in one of its
you know, earlier formations. But now you can write and we'll send you the Flux Kit and you can try yourself, or you can look online and get inspiration and make it yourself. Because one of the beautiful things about a Flux Kit, ours cost a lot of money, but the whole principle is DIY and you can do these things on a very low budget. And I think that part of it is to allow people to make these experimental gestures that don't have to be perfect. They don't have to look like high art, but they can make big change in the world. And they can do just what you were saying a moment ago, Patrick. They can, you know, they can use artistic means to get us to think differently, to be more expansive about the way we frame a question or a problem, or come at it from a different direction other than, you know, the more rigid, you know, processes that are demanded in certain kinds of scenarios, in a policy environment, in a school environment, you know, in an assignment, in the way things are normally done. So I hope that the Flux Kit opens that up. So it is not the end. It is just a moment in the project, which, you know, means that the team is wrapping up, but we hope you all take it and run with it. And that listening to this series will inspire you to be in touch with us.
That's great. And actually, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, how the dinner and a recipe in a box, and how, you know, when you get that, you pretty much know what's supposed to come out. And the Flux Kit is a box with all kinds of materials and potentialities, but it really leaves itself open to a lot of experimentation and also a lot of learning through doing. So yeah, I think it's a great resource and a great vehicle for SEF. So with that, we're going to wrap up and encourage you to join us for the next episode, and hopefully all of them. I think you'll find we learn a lot, we have lots to think about, and a few laughs in every episode, and we know you'll really enjoy being with us. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the sixth series of the Just Powers podcast, Reflector, on the topic of speculative energy futures, which uses research creation as an interdisciplinary method for approaching climate justice and energy transition. Be sure to visit the Just Powers website at justpowers.ca, where you can learn more about speculative energy futures and explore the Flux Kit. You will also find information about our ongoing projects and access to more resources. This podcast is made possible by support from Future Energy Systems Canada, the First Research Excellence Fund, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, the COOL Institute of Advanced Study, the University of Alberta, Alberta Eco Trust, and the City of Edmonton. Special thanks to our guest host, Patrick Mann. This series was co-produced by myself, Sheena Wilson, Patrick Mann, Katie Lewandowski, and Sarah Taylor. Post-production was provided by Story Darling Studios in Edmonton, Alberta. This episode was edited by Sarah Taylor, CCE, and Blair Drover, mixed and mastered by Tony Bao, and music from Artlist.